Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Ever since man looked up at the night sky, we've been wondering about what's out there. At first, we wondered exactly what those twinkling objects really were. Well, now, because of science, we know. But questions remain, and even as we explore space by sending men and women into it, we continue to wonder, are we alone? Is there life out there? Later in the program, we hear about how Discovery Place will help you experience what's beyond our atmosphere, as well as a new planetarium show exploring challenges to be faced by astronauts during their 2-year mission to Mars. But first, we talk about what's out there, including the possibility of life on other planets and solar systems, with a man some consider to be the human face of outer space. Astrophysicist, author, and host of the Star Talk podcast, Neil deGrasse Tyson. He'll be in Charlotte tomorrow night at Ovens Auditorium to talk about our search for life in the universe. It's based on years of his research and that of others, and part of his tireless efforts to make that research understandable and available to all. And Neil deGrasse Tyson joins us now. So, Dr. Tyson, you're going to be at Ovens Auditorium here in Charlotte to talk about mankind's search for life in the universe. And I know that the United States has the rover vehicle on Mars, which has allegedly perhaps found some life on Mars or former life on Mars, which we will talk about. But first, tell me, aside from the
word allegedly, this is not legal. Allegedly.
Okay, maybe.
Is this evidence or there's no evidence? Allegedly. Okay.
Good. Well, maybe it will point to life on Mars at some point. But before we talk about that, let's talk about who else is looking for life outside of Earth. Is it just the United States or is this a worldwide effort?
Well, it depends on what you mean by looking for life. So there's life of any kind, could be microbial, bacterial, this sort of thing. The United States has a rather vibrant program in place to search for just that. For example, we have a mission to one of Jupiter's moons, Europa. That's one of the moons that has an icy outer surface, but through tidal stresses of its orbit around Jupiter, it's basically getting heat pumped into it, which has melted the ice beneath the surface, and it's been an ocean of liquid water. It's been liquid for billions of years. Life on Earth, all evidence points, began in our oceans. So if you got another place that has oceans, maybe that'd be a good place to look for life as we know it. So we have a mission called the Europa Clipper that's headed there. We'll get there for a couple of years or so. I forgot the exact arrival time, but it'll loop. It has special ice penetrating radar to look for what kind of life might exist beneath that surface. And as you duly noted in the intro, we have, but I'll add some nuance, we have an SUV-sized rover on Mars that's been there for quite some time now. That brought a helicopter with it, by the way. First time anyone had ever flown in the atmosphere of a place other than Earth. And all of these missions to Mars are inspired by the search for life. The landing points are where there was once liquid water. And we have a water bias, understandably. Every place on Earth where there's liquid water, there is evidence of life, even the Dead Sea. Whoever named it the Dead Sea didn't have access to a microscope. It's that simple. Thinking that their senses were fully what is necessary to understand the world around them, and they weren't. So the search for water, follow the water, is the mantra of NASA. So the United States has led this effort. We're all over Mars in ways that other countries can only dream about, and our missions to the outer solar system. So there's that. But then there's like looking for intelligent aliens. And this requires radio telescopes dedicated to receiving signals, interpreting them, analyzing them. We have a whole center called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, which is in Northern California. That's their whole purpose in life, is to study signals from radio telescopes, figure out how to send signals out, and in search for what could be intelligence lurking, possibly in plain sight.
So as you well know, I'm not telling you anything I haven't heard from you. There are an unfathomable... There are an unfathomable number of galaxies that are home to an even more...
But we have a word for that. It's called an astronomical number of galaxies.
Okay.
That's where you get that number.
And even a larger astronomical number of stars that likely have solar systems surrounding them, planets rotating around them. Is there, in your opinion, a greater likelihood that there is life out there or that there is not?
Oh, anyone who studied the problem, you would be inexcusably egocentric or completely consumed by a religious tenet that we would be alone in the universe. If you study the problem, but there's some religious philosophies that require that we on Earth are the object of God's creation, and therefore the rest of the universe is just there. Right. And so that has an interesting sort of religious philosophical tracking back through time. But anyone who has studied the problem, as I and all of my colleagues have, the universe is old. Earth is old, not as old as the universe, but Earth is old. The ingredients for life are everywhere in the universe. We are made of those common ingredients, and the earliest signs of life on Earth appeared very shortly after they possibly could have. Very shortly, on these terms, a couple hundred, between 1 and 200 million years, out of 4.5 billion. So you combine all of that, you say, we're made of common ingredients. These ingredients are everywhere in the universe. Life began on Earth very quickly, and there's a boatload, an astronomical number of star systems and galaxies. So no one among us who studied the problem is walking around suggesting we are alone in the universe.
So if we were to find life, or if life were to exist someplace, like say Mars, would we necessarily recognize it, and would we necessarily ever be able to communicate with it?
Yeah, so the recognition one is an interesting philosophical question. Are we so biased as to what our definition of life is, mm-hmm. that if something presented itself and didn't fit our expectations or our biases, would we even recognize it as life? And you know, is a rock alive? Well, we can just define life in ways that we're not thinking that rocks are alive or mountains, even though Earth has the continents shift, there are volcanoes, there are things happening on Earth. And there's this new agey flavored concept called Gaia, G-A-I-A, which refers to Earth as a living, or the planet, as sort of a living organism that breathes and cares about its own survival. I thought it was a fun sort of excursion, philosophical excursion, but the idea that Earth somehow is self-healing, Mars once had liquid water coursing over its surface, and now it's bone dry and it's sterilized on its surface. Whoever was preaching the Gaia hypothesis for Mars is now extinct. So I just, it's easy to be in something that is thriving and then declaring that that's a deep philosophical truth about the universe. So I'm not in that camp, but so I don't mind. It's fun to think about it, but I'm not in that camp.
So let's talk about what the rover just, I don't want to say allegedly, what they
you
just,
said it.
What the rover just found on Mars.
The rover alleges in the court of law.
Well, they found that they found rocks that show evidence of possible life in the past, correct?
Yeah. So let's be a little more precise. So it discovered rocks that had a peculiar kind of pattern in them, because geologists know, they know their rocks, all right? And if the rock has something that's not rock-like, then you bring in somebody else, like the biologists or just somebody who can think about what might have happened in the rock other than the sediments that would naturally occur in whatever water systems were coursing on its surface. And this SUV-sized rover is, of course, a laboratory with many, a scientific laboratory with many different science experiments on it. And one of them was, what are these sort of nodules contain? They're like leopard spots of nodules. And you find out that, no, it's not evidence of life, but it's evidence of what life would leave behind had it ever existed in those nodules. And when I say, we're talking like microbial life here, of course, right? Not creatures that crawl out of the holes or out of the crevasses of Mars. So it'd be like walking around and finding poop, okay? And you say, the poop is not alive, but something made the poop. And right. there you have the chemical evidence of it, of microbial life. I mean, from billions of years ago. So that was that announcement.
You were kind of joking about it's not evidence of things crawling out of rocks, creatures coming out of rocks, but could we find that there or elsewhere? Could we find evidence that there were rudimentary life forms on Mars in the past, a long time
ago? Well, so that's the whole anthropological fossil remains effort would be. So for the animal to have evidence of there once been a thriving biota, not only of plants but animals, you would need some kind of fossil remains. So that'd be kind of interesting if in one of the ravines we found fossils. You remember the Aldovu Gorge, in Kenya, where we found the remains of Lucy. Okay, right. That was a gorge because that was a free cut through the earth. All right, so you already had access to layers from millions of years prior. And so those are free cuts where you don't have to excavate with diggers to try to get into what might be below the surface. So in Mars, yeah, if you want to say there was once animals there, we'd have to find fossil remains. Or here's something really cool. If asteroids had hit Mars while it was thriving with life, and those rocks escaped Mars, which we know they can do in an asteroid impact, and travel through space and land on Earth. By the way, we already know that has happened because we have Martian meteorites on Earth, and we've never come back from Mars, to put them on our planet. So we know this has happened, and it's called panspermia, if in fact this cross-contamination contains life. We have a word for it, panspermia. But if it's possible that one of these meteorites, we also have meteorites that landed here from the moon. These are records from millions and billions of years ago. If there's possibly fossil remnants within those meteorites, then that's the fastest and easiest way to know what was going on Mars a billion years ago.
We're spending time with our personal astrophysicist. That's what he calls himself, Neil deGrasse Tyson, the head of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, will be at Ovens Auditorium tomorrow night to speak about the search for life in the universe. We're picking his brain about that right now, and we will continue to do so in just 90 seconds. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Today we're doing what we can to explore outer space with our feet firmly planted on the ground. Later, we hear about how you can have an exploration of your own at Discovery Place. But first, we continue our conversation with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson about the search for life in the universe. Is it possible? When we think about life, we think about ourselves. We live within certain temperature ranges. We must have water. We must have
liquid water.
We must have a food supply. We must have oxygen to breathe. Is it possible in your mind that there are other forms of life that don't need any of that?
So a couple of things. First, all the microbes in your gut thrive in the absence of oxygen. Okay. And their byproduct is methane and hydrogen sulfide, H2S. Hydrogen sulfide is why your gaseous effluences are unpleasant for others to smell. Okay. And so there's life forms on Earth that not only don't want oxygen, the oxygen environment is hostile to them. So that's one example. Another is, on Earth, we have what are called extremophiles, which are life forms that thrive in conditions that would otherwise kill us or any sort of room temperature loving life on Earth. So, you know, polar bears do the backstroke in 31 degree salt oceanic waters. Okay. If I put you in there, you're dead 15 minutes later. To me, that counts as a range of conditions under which you would find life. There's life forms in the many places on Earth, but a highly studied one. There's what we call black smokers. It's a place like off the coast of Oregon and Washington, the Juan de Fuca Ridge, where the hot magma from below Earth's crust is sort of gurgling up. It's heating the water. That's an energy source. There are life forms at the bottom there that thrive on geochemical energy and not on solar energy, because we ultimately are driven by solar power, because plants get energy from the sun. We eat plants and or we eat animals that eat the plants. So we are ultimately solar powered. These are life forms that are not. And so the study of extremophiles one other place, there's Lake Vostok in Antarctica. This is a body of water completely covered in ice. Okay. But it remains liquid down there, and it hasn't seen air. It hasn't seen anything. I forgot over hundreds of thousands of years. And so this is a laboratory. That's the wrong word. It's a repository of whatever was thriving back then, untouched, uninfluenced, unharmed by anything going on today. Not any of the nuclear fallout, none of the pollution. And if there are life forms that are down there, maybe they're very different from what we find up here. So the whole study of extremophiles is food, if I may use that word, food for the study of alien life elsewhere. And you want to know, can we communicate with them? Here's a question for you. Can you meaningfully communicate with chimpanzees? I think the answer to that is no. Okay. Meaningfully. I mean, I'll meet you at 4:30 tonight. Let's go out to dinner and get a coffee at Starbucks and I'll meet you. No. These are simple sentences that any human can understand. Simple gestures. No, you can't. The smartest chimp cannot be taught long division. Okay. It's just certain things that just put a line and say that it's not happening. And the chimp is the closest genetic relative we have on Earth. You're going to go to an alien and think you're going to have a conversation with it? If we are to the alien what chimps are to us, forget about it. They will wonder how they will scratch their head. Do they have heads? I don't know. They never have hair. You ever notice that? We never give them with hairdos. Aliens are always bald. But I don't know why, but for once, I want an alien with a hairdo. Okay.
It's because they have to. They can't leave their hair products at the airport when they leave in their spaceships. They have to.
That's
leave
what it
there.
Is. Wait. Let me just finish that point. So the alien will see us and. We would probably be, if they're smarter than us, by any amount, really. I mean, to get here by spaceship, it kind of presumes that, because we haven't left low Earth orbit since 1972, and they crossed the galaxy to arrive here. So they probably cannot conjure a simple enough thought for us to comprehend.
So that leads me to this, because we've sent space probes out, long-term space probes, on which we've put discs of recordings of various human activity, and we've put messages in writing, et cetera, on these things, I guess thinking that if an alien being finds this, they will be able to understand us. And it would seem that if we're looking for intelligent life, they may not be able to communicate with us either, even if they're highly intelligent. So let's talk about these unidentified flying objects. We no longer call them that, but last year, or during the last waning days of the Biden administration, the Defense Department released videos of fighter pilots who were finding what we used to call UFOs on their radar screens, moving in a manner at which we cannot duplicate and at speeds that we cannot achieve. What's your theory about that?
It's a mystery.
Were they alien spacecraft?
No. Wait. Just to be clear. Just because you don't know what you're looking at, it doesn't mean you know what you're looking at. Okay? You can't use the absence of knowledge of this mysterious thing on the screen and use that as evidence that you know what's on the screen. All right. The U in UFO, which was rebranded UAP by the government, I think to reduce the giggle factor, but I was perfectly fine with UFO, unidentified anomalous phenomenon. I forgot what the A stand for. It used to be unidentified aerial phenomenon. Anyhow, but it's a substitute for UFO. If it's unidentified, it's unidentified. Period. Okay, the universe brims with mysteries. It's okay to say, I don't know what this is. If you're going to say, it's an alien, what based on what? Because you don't know what it is, therefore it's an alien? No. By the way, of all the things it could be, aliens would be last on my list. Because that's an extraordinary explanation, which requires extraordinary evidence. And not just a fuzzy tic-tac doing things on a F-18 fighter pilot screen. That's not extraordinary evidence. That's weird thing in the detector evidence, okay? Extraordinary evidence would be the alien walks up to the White House, okay? Or something that doesn't show up fuzzy in front of some people. Why is it that we have 6 billion smartphones in the world, each capable of obtaining high resolution, sharp video and audio and pictures, and the best evidence we have for aliens visiting are fuzzy tic-tacs seen by a couple of fighter pilots? I don't get it.
Yeah.
We should have way better evidence than that. And consider Area 51, where we're surely stockpiling all of our aliens. The janitor, okay? No one has snuck out a photo from in there. That hasn't happened yet. Yeah, if a janitor does it, the janitor loses his job overnight. But he'll be the most famous, richest janitor there ever was the next day. And that's never happened, really? I got one for you. In the Ben Franklin's, what that thing that he published?
Almanac.
Poor Richard's Almanac. Yeah, one of his issues, he has some quotes, he's a very quotable guy. One of them is, three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead. <That's>... So all this thing, there's a cover-up and thousands of people are in the cover-up, that's not how humans work. I'm sorry. And the same people who are certain there's this masterminding government cover-up, generally, those are the same people who will say on another day, the government is this bloated, inefficient system, and it should all be, you can't have it both ways. You can't have a bloated, inefficient system that is masterminding a cover-up with hundreds, and in some cases, thousands of people.
Science fiction, from which a lot of the things that we have today have come to pass, for instance,
I would say fewer than people think when they make that statement, but yes. The answer is yes, but
so
it's way less than you think.
in science fiction, whether it's a book or a film, usually aliens are to be feared because they're here to harm us, except maybe the day the Earth stood still. They didn't seem to want to harm us. They wanted us to de-arm and warn us about nuclear weapons. But aliens are always to be feared. And maybe there's a reason to fear them, even if they don't mean us harm, because when European explorers came to the North America continent, a lot of indigenous people died because of diseases for which they were not prepared. Could that happen?
By the way, they were colonists, not explorers, just to be clear.
But yeah. Could that happen, even if we find a rudimentary life forms on some other planet or moon? Could exposure to that expose us to things that we have no defenses for?
Yeah. So the two separable variables there. One is, like I said, you're an explorer if you gather data and you just leave things the way they are. Columbus was not an explorer, and none of the people in that era were explorers. They carried flags of Spain to declare land for the king. So that's not exploration. That's a very important distinction that a scientist would make relative to conquistadors and anybody else who was trying to conquer the world. That's A. B, you are correct. When you have any population that has lesser technology than one that arrives, it has never boded well for the civilization that had lesser technology, ever. Okay, so I'm agreeing with you there. Now about diseases and microbes and other things, there's an entire branch of NASA called the Department of Planetary Protection. Okay? Planetary Protection. That makes sure, their goal is to make sure that in our probes that we send out, we do not forward contaminate where we're going with microbes that somebody sneezed onto the spacecraft before they got launched. Because it might be a place where we'd one day want to look for life. And you don't want to discover the COVID virus or the rhinovirus that we put there and then somehow contaminate our data thinking that that was formed on the planet of your destination. So there's that. Also, there are protocols for what you do when an object returns to Earth. It's kept in quarantine. It's very antiseptic. In the environment in which it's placed. So there are protections in place for that. Now, consider, however, that we don't know how aliens would treat us, aliens that are smarter with greater technologies. But we do know how we treat each other. So these depictions of aliens as hostile, to me, is more the fear of how we know we would treat ourselves based on actual evidence rather than any knowledge we would have of how aliens would treat us because no such knowledge exists. So it's really fear of ourselves. It's a mirror. Their behavior to us, I see that as a mirror of our own behavior.
What do you think would happen if we found life? This would clearly change a lot of traditional thought, religious and otherwise, about who we are and why we are here and what our place in the universe is. So how would we react to it? Would it be greeted with the same kind of skepticism that we see climate science being greeted at? Would there be an attempt to distance ourselves from a truth that you folks as astrophysicists have uncovered? What do you think would be the end result?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've thought a lot about that, but I don't claim that my answers are definitive or they're the answer. Surely there are other nuances that others can bring based on what their life experiences are and what their profession might happen to be. There are some branches of religion religious sects that require that humans be the one and only object of God's creation with nothing permitted elsewhere in the universe. And so there'd be some denial at first, for sure. If the life form is decidedly and obviously, quote, lesser than us in intellect and in power and ability, that doesn't really pose a threat to anybody's preeminence. But if they're clearly smarter and clearly more powerful, then people have to contend with that. Because if religious people would have to somehow factor that in or give up their religion entirely, because did God make them? And if he did, he prefers them because they're more powerful than us, and they can control us, they can enslave us, they can turn us into their pets. So who is the God of humans who also made that? Do they have a God? I mean, it totally stirs that pot of thinking, and they're going to have to resolve that. Okay? So that's the first part of it. As for the rest of society, there'd be intriguing biological questions. How is its identity encoded? Is it DNA? DNA is a very complex molecule. Can you make that twice on one planet and on a whole other planet? Or does life find some other way of being alive not represented here on Earth? Here's an interesting analogy. Geologists are comfortable in almost any planetary surface because they've studied what minerals and molecules do under heat, under pressure, when they solidify. They have a sense of that. They may be less familiar with them on another planet. They might be more mineral rich, whatever, but they're not looking stupefied at what's in front of them. Could it be that biology has similar foundational starting points? Could it be that, you know, crystal formation, which is not fundamentally different from DNA formation or RNA formation or any of the earlier stages that lead to biology? Is that inevitable? The way rock formation is inevitable when you make a rocky planet. We don't know how to answer that because life as we know it exists only on Earth and nowhere else. So the biologists have yet to be challenged in that way.
When we continue our conversation with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, we explore something a little different, the threat, if any, posed by any encounter we might have with extraterrestrial life. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and live stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Coming up, we get a preview of what Discovery Place is about to offer to help you with your own exploration of the cosmos. But first, a few final moments with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who will be in Charlotte tomorrow night at Evans Auditorium to talk about the search for life in the universe. Just a couple more questions. Given the fact that you said that the entity with the greater technology is the greater threat. I'm paraphrasing.
No,
you said.
The humans with the greater technology is the greater threat.
Well,
I don't know if the aliens behave the way humans do. Yeah, that would be really scary. We'd have good reason to be afraid if they're just like us.
Well, I don't know how to say this question, but if aliens, if they exist and they have the ability to travel through space and someday they arrive here, is the species that arrives on an extraterrestrial body first going to necessarily have the greater technology, the greater knowledge, be the greater threat, as opposed to our arriving there first? Does that make any sense?
Yeah. But we can just speak practically about that. Like I said, if you take Earth and shrink it down to a schoolroom globe, the farthest away from that schoolroom globe we've been since 1972 is 1 centimeter. That's 53 years of space travel. That's the farthest humans have gotten from Earth since 1972. 0.4 inches for those who are not metric fluent. So to say we might be the first to land on their planet of intelligent aliens, get that out of your system, because that's not happening anytime soon. And it's way more fun to imagine them visiting us. And possibly more realistic.
And if we were to able to do it, it would be because of science. We could not have gotten to the moon without science. We could not have cured
diseases. And technology, yes.
We could not have cured diseases without science. We could not have iPhones in our hands without science. And yet interest in science, and evidently by anecdotal evidence, the quality of science education in America doesn't seem to be on par with other countries. If that's true, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, it'll get worse before it gets better. So the United States, based on my read of our conduct, 20th century primarily, but even further into the 21st, is we are very good at being reactive rather than proactive. So we can coast on our laurels if we don't see a threat. If there's no threat, then the urge to do better is kind of not there. We just, you know, go to the beach and hang out. But if we see a threat, then we mobilize, take action, and then leapfrog to a new position compared to where we once were. That has happened continually throughout American 20th century history and beyond. Mm-hmm. We weren't the first in space. It was Russia. We freak out. We say, well, let's go to the moon. So then we go to the moon, and then we look over our shoulder, and that Russia's not there. Then we stop going to the moon. So it wasn't in our DNA as America. No. It was, you know, the godless communists, we got to show the world that we're better than they are. We didn't do it proactively, we did it reactively. Right now, we're returning to the moon with the Artemis program, okay? Artemis 1 was an unmanned ship that went to the moon and came back. Artemis 2 is going to have a crew that's going to go to the moon and come back, but not land. Artemis hasn't happened yet. Artemis 3 is going to go to the moon and land. This was just kicked in 7-8 years ago. How come we didn't stay on the moon in 1972 or go back in 1980, 1990, 2000, 2010? What's up with that? Oh, well, if you ask people, say, oh, it was time. It's time to go back. No, part the curtains. Oh, China says they're going to put taikonauts, their version of an astronaut, on the moon. Then all of a sudden, by the way, it was announced under Trump 1, okay, back in between 2016 and 2020. Do I get my years correct there? No. When was Trump won?
I think it was 16.
Yeah.
Things move so fast, who can remember?
But anyhow, it was announced under Trump 1, and then it was smoothly carried into the following administration. The following administration said, oh, that was Trump, and Trump, we don't like Trump, so let's delete everything that he did. No, no. Our place in space is a geopolitical force, not a national political force. It's geopolitical in response to perceived or real threats that we see in the world. So China says they're going back. We're going back to the moon. What? It's the right time. Sure, let's do it. So as our science fades and other countries make discoveries and patents and it drives economies and we start feeling it in our pocketbooks, and the great scientists are no longer staying here. They're fearsome of immigration policies. They go to other country. I have colleagues who've gotten calls from Europe saying, we see science is not getting its due over there. Come on over to Europe. That's kind of what we did with other countries for decades. We didn't call them up, but we were the shining beacon of free expression of research and ingenuity. And we attract, it was a brain drain from other countries. It was their loss, but our gain, okay? It was our gain. We collected all the brilliant people in the world. They came here. But if that climate changes, let me not use the word climate. If that environment changes and that those conditions are no longer favorable to stimulate and promote science and engineering innovation, then we will fade until one day we're at the bottom, we wake up in the cave, and we say, how did we land here? We've got to do something. Then we all band together and do something about it.
So you are here to talk about the search for life in the universe. Let's say we find it, in whatever form we find it in. What's the next question?
Oh, well, as a scientist, is what's the life made of? Is it intelligent life? And if it is, what's their understanding of the universe? And let's compare it with ours. Can they learn something from us? Can we learn something from them? That presumes we can even communicate at all. And if they're really, really much smarter than us, there's nothing we can do. I mean, that for all we know, they created Earth as a literal aquarium terrarium for their own amusement. And in the limit of that, we are just a simulation in their alien kids' basement, okay? If they're that much smarter than us. I mean, when you walk down the street and you see a worm, you're not saying, gee, I wonder what that worm is thinking. No, you're not having those thoughts any more than a really intelligent alien would be thinking, gee, I wonder what those humans are thinking. Whoa, yeah, they look interesting. No, we're not. Interesting. I promise you, we will not be interesting to highly intelligent aliens.
That's because they've been watching TV shows from the 1950s that have escaped our environment.
Exactly. So. That's called the radio bubble. This is our radio signature. So our cultural emissaries are like Howdy Doody, the Honeymooners, you know, what else was going on back then? Flash Gordon, you know, that's their first exposure to who and what we are as a species. I think they'll analyze that and conclude there's no sign of intelligent life on Earth.
Except at Evans Auditorium tomorrow.
Oh,
evening.
Thank you. What a night. That was a beautiful plug right there.
Thank you very much. Tomorrow evening, Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about the search for life in the universe. And thank you for talking about it with us.
Thanks for your curiosity.
Most of us will never go into space, nor will we approach the understanding of the cosmos that Neil deGrasse Tyson has. But that doesn't mean we can't try to expand what we know or even get a kind of out-of-this-world experience. And that is what Discovery Place is offering beginning on October the 18th. They're preparing to take you on a journey through the cosmos with an interactive exhibit called Above and Beyond. And right now, you can go to Mars with their planetary show, The Ultimate Voyage. And here to fill us in on all of that is Melissa Mulliger, Senior Director of Communications at Discovery Place. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let's start with the experience that's available Thursdays through Sundays right now, and that's the Digistar 7 Planetarium Show, Mars, The Ultimate Voyage. This is in your IMAX theater, and it helps people experience what a two-year mission to Mars might be like for astronauts who will go there. How?
Well, yes. Right now in our IMAX Dome Theater at Discovery Place Science, we are showing this planetarium show that really highlights NASA research and training initiatives that are preparing the next generation of astronauts who will head to Mars. And many factors are taken into consideration for a journey like that, such as the long distance, altered gravity, getting there and back safely. And so viewers get a glimpse into the challenges and triumphs of astronauts as they navigate deep space.
And that includes isolation and gravity changes and things like that, right?
Just being alone
for 2 years.
Yes. Yeah. And so what comes into play is, you know, learning how creativity, collaboration, and expertise across various fields are crucial for success on a journey like that.
Obviously, you want to get kids excited about this because they are the future. And that's one of the missions of Discovery Place. But when you realize that going to Mars is not as safe as watching Star Trek, when you realize that there are real dangers involved, when you're exposed to them through an experience like this and the other exhibit that we'll talk about, do you worry that some budding astrophysicists or astronauts might have second thoughts about pursuing what for many must be dreams of being part of this exploratory experience?
I imagine that people who are pursuing careers and professions like this have a passion for it. And so they are willing to take those risks, to try new things, to be innovative. Yeah. And that's certainly part of our mission at Discovery Place Science as well. We are thinkers and doers and testers. So we are excited for these opportunities for those future generations.
I grew up at the time of the moon missions. Me and all of my friends were very excited about going into space and thought we'd all be on rocket ships at some point in our lifetimes. That's clearly not going to happen unless you're a multimillionaire now. But do you find that people today, young people today, have that same kind of interest and enthusiasm in space travel?
We do. We see at the museum specifically a great interest in space and aerospace themes. We've had exhibits in the past about Apollo, those missions. We had an exhibit about lunar landings, and those are very, very popular with our visitors, especially young visitors.
So this trip to Mars can be experienced right now, but on October the 18th, you will be opening an exhibit called Above and Beyond, which will be in residence through April, at 6 months through April 19th. It's an interactive aerospace exhibition which explores not just the universe beyond our atmosphere, but how aerospace innovations are already playing a role in our lives. Without spoiling that experience, can you give me some examples of that?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, aerospace innovations have shaped our world for quite some time, you know, from the earliest dreams of the Wright brothers to present day space exploration to tomorrow's cutting edge aviation technologies. And in this exhibition, visitors will have a chance to explore these themes across five galleries, featuring dozens of interactive stations. So a few highlights I can share. One is designing and test flying your own supersonic jet. Another is riding a simulated space elevator to the edge of Earth's atmosphere. And then one more I'll share, which is my personal favorite, is exploring the forces of flight as a bird. So there is a group flying experience where you and a few other people try to fly and navigate the skies as a flock of migrating birds, which is harder than it sounds.
I was going to ask you how you accomplish that. Is it like a video game? How do you do it?
There is an interactive screen, and the experience kind of transforms you into a bird. And you learn about, you know, why birds fly in a V formation. You learn about propulsion and just some of those key components of flight.
And this exhibit where you're able to design and test fly your own supersonic jet. I saw a still photograph of this because this is obviously a traveling Smithsonian-based exhibit. But it kind of looks, reminded me of that NASCAR driving experience at the NASCAR Hall of Fame. Is that what it's essentially like? You sit there and you design it, but then you actually sit in this vehicle and fly it?
That's right. You are testing your design to see if you can make it through the course, the flight course, as a pilot would.
So this is a joint exhibit that's put together by Boeing, which is one of our providers of air travel vehicles, NASA, and the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And it takes you from, I think, before the Wright brothers, for which, of course, there is a North Carolina tie, into today and then beyond into tomorrow. Who is this aimed at? I know there is always an educational component at things at Discovery Place, but this sounds like something that I could enjoy as the inner 13-year-old in me.
Of course, this exhibition is geared towards all ages. It certainly does promote STEM-based learning and inspires those future generations of pilots, engineers, innovators, but also aerospace enthusiasts. It really gives visitors a one-of-a-kind opportunity to explore that global impact that aerospace innovations have had on the world. So we're really looking forward to welcoming visitors of all ages when it opens.
So Above and Beyond begins on October the 18th and will run through April 19th. You have some time for that. And Mars, The Ultimate Voyage, is in the IMAX Dome Theater right now and will be there when Above and Beyond takes up residence later in October. And that takes place Thursday through Sunday. Alyssa Mulliker, Senior Director of Communications at Discovery Place. Thank you for joining us, and I'll see you in outer space.
Thank you so much.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.